This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Farming of Bones by Edwige Danticat, narrated by Adenrale Ojo. Jephthah called together the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. The Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan leading to Ephraim, and whenever a survivor of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead asked him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he replied, "No," they said, "All right, say Shibboleth." If he said Sibboleth, because he could not pronounce the word correctly, they seized and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. 40,000 were killed at the time. Judges chapter 12, verses 4 through 6. 1. His name is Sebastien Onius. He comes most nights to put an end to my nightmare, the one I have all the time of my parents drowning. While my body is struggling against sleep, fighting itself to awaken, he whispers for me to lie still while I take you back. "Back where?" I ask, without feeling my lips moving. He says, "I will take you back into the cave across the river." I lurch at him and stumble, trying to rise. He levels my balance with the tips of his long but curled fingers, each of them alive on its own as they crawl towards me. I grab his body, my head barely reaching the center of his chest. He is lavishly handsome by the dim light of my castor oil lamp, even though the cane stalks have ripped apart most of the skin of his shiny black face, leaving him with crisscrossed trails of furrowed scars. His arms are as wide as one of my bare thighs. They are steel, hardened by 4 years of sugarcane harvests. "Look at you," he says, taking my face into one of his spacious bowl-shaped hands, where the palms have lost their lifelines to the machetes that cut the cane. "You are glowing like a Christmas lantern, even with this skin that is the color of driftwood ashes in the rain." "Do not say those things to me," I mumble, the shadows of sleep fighting me still. "This type of talk makes me feel naked." He runs his hand up and down my back. His rough, calloused palms nip and chafe my skin, while the string of yellow coffee beans on his bracelet rolls over and caresses the tender places along my spine. "Take off your nightdress," he suggests, "and be naked for true. When you are uncovered, you will know that you are fully awake and I can simply look at you and be happy." Then he slips across to the other side of the room and watches every movement of flesh as I shed my clothes. He is in a corner, away from the lamp, a shadowed place where he sees me better than I see him. "It is good for you to learn and trust that I am near you even when you can't place the balls of your eyes on me," he says. This makes me laugh and laugh loud, too loud for the middle of the night. Now I am fully disrobed and fully awake. I stumble quickly into his arms with my nightdress at my ankles. Then, as he says I am too afraid to fold in two and disappear. I'm afraid to be shy, distant, and cold. I am afraid I cease to exist when he's not there. I'm like one of those sea stones that sucks its colors inside and loses its translucence once it's taken out into the sun, out of the froth of the waves. When he's not there, I'm afraid I know no one, and no one knows me. "Your clothes cover more than your skin," he says. "You become this uniform they make for you. Now you are only you, just the flesh." It's either be in a nightmare or be nowhere at all, or otherwise simply float inside these remembrances, grieving for who I was, and even more for what I've become. But all this when he's not there. Look at your perfect little face, he says. Your perfect little shape, your perfect little body. A woman child with deep black skin, all the shades of black in you. What we see and what we don't see, the good and the bad. He touches me like one brush of a single feather, perhaps fearing, too, that I might vanish. Everything in your face is as it should be, he says. Your nose where it should be. Oh, oui, it would have been sad, I say, if my nose had been placed at the bottom of my feet. This time he is the one who laughs. Up close, his laughter crumples his face, his shoulders rise and fall in an uneven rhythm. I'm never sure whether he is only laughing or also crying at the same time, even though I have never seen him cry. I fall back asleep, draped over him. In the morning, before the first lemongrass-scented ray of sunlight, he is gone. But I can still feel his presence there, in the small square of my room. I can smell his sweat, which is as thick as sugarcane juice when he's worked too much. I can still feel his lips, the eggplant violet gums that taste of greasy goat milk, boiled to candied sweetness with mustard-colored potatoes. I feel my cheeks rising to his densest toenails, fingernails, the hollow beneath my cheekbones, where the bracelet nicked me and left a perfectly crescent moon-shaped drop of dried blood. I feel the wet lines in my back where his tongue gently traced the life-giving veins to the chine, the faint handprints on my waist where he held on too tight, perhaps during some moment when he felt me sleeping. And I can still count his breaths, and how sometimes they raced much faster than the beating of his heart. When I was a child, I used to spend hours playing with my shadow, something that my father warned could give me nightmares, nightmares like seeing voices twirl in a hurricane of rainbow colors, and hearing the odd shapes of things rise up and speak to define themselves. Playing with my shadow made me, an only child, feel less alone. Whenever I had playmates, they were never quite real or present for me. I considered them only replacements for my shadow. There were many shadows, too, in the life I had beyond childhood. At times, Sébastien Onius guarded me from the shadows. At other times, he was one of them. 2. Births and deaths were my parents' work. I never thought I would help at a birth myself until the screams rang through the valley that morning. One voice like a thousand glasses breaking. I was sitting in the yard on the grass, sewing the last button on a new indigo-colored shirt I was making for Sébastien when I heard. Dropping the sewing basket, I ran through the house to the señora's bedroom. Señora Valencia was lying on her bed, her skin raining sweat and the bottom part of her dress soaking in baby fluid. Her water had broken. As I lifted her legs to remove the sheets, Don Ignacio, Signora Valencia's father, we called him Papi, charged into the room. Standing over her, he tugged at his butterfly-shaped mustache with one age-modeled hand and patted her damp forehead with the other.
Ay, no!
The Signora shouted through her clenched, grinding teeth.
It's too soon, not for 2 months yet.
Papi and I both took a few steps away when we saw the blood-speckled flow streaming from between his daughter's legs. I will go fetch the doctor, he said, his hide-like skin instantly pale to the color of warm eggshells. As he rushed out the door, he shoved me back towards the señora's bed, as if to say with that abrupt gesture that the situation being what it was, he had no other choice but to trust his own child's life to my inept hands. Thankfully, after Papi left, the señora was still for a moment. Her pain seemed to have subsided a bit, drowning in the depths of the mattress, She took a few breaths of relief. We sat for a while with her fingers clinging to mine, like when we were girls and we both slept in the same room. Even though she was supposed to sleep in her own canopy bed and I was to sleep on a smaller cot across from hers, she would invite me onto her bed after her father had gone to sleep, and the two of us would jump up and down on the mattress, play with our shadows, and pretend we were four happy girls forcing the housemaid, Juana, to come in and threaten to wake Poppy, who would give us a deeper desire for slumber with a spanking.
Amabel, is the baby's bed ready?
With her hand still grasping mine, Signora Valencia glanced at the cradle, squeezed between the louvered patio doors and her favorite armoire deeply carved with giant orchids and hummingbirds in flight. Everything is prepared, Signora, I said. Even though I wasn't used to praying, I whispered a few words to La Virgen de la Carmen that the doctor would come before the Signora was in agony again.
I want my husband.
The Signora clamped her eyes shut, quietly forcing the tears down her face. We will send for him, I said. Tell me how your body feels.
The pain is less now, but when it comes on strong, it feels like someone shoves a knife into my back.
The baby could be leaning on her back, I thought, remembering one of my father's favorite expressions when he and my mother were gathering leaves to cram into rum and firewater bottles before rushing off to a birthing. Without remembering what those leaves were, I couldn't lessen the Signora's pain. Yes, there was plenty of rum and firewater in the house, but I didn't want to leave her alone and go to the pantry to fetch them. Anything could happen in my absence. The worst of it being if a lady of her stature had to push that child out alone, like a field hen suddenly feeling her labor pains beneath a tent of cane.
Amabel, I am not going to die, am I?
She was shouting at the top of the soft murmuring voice she'd had since childhood, panting with renewed distress between her words. We were alone in the house now. I had to calm her, to help her, as she had always counted on me to do, as her father had always counted on me to do.
Before this, the most pain I ever felt was when a wasp bit the back of my hand and made it swell, she declared.
This will pain you more, but not so much more, I said. A soft breeze drifted in through the small gaps in the patio doors. She reached for the mosquito netting tied above her head, seized it, and twisted the cloth. Goose flesh sprouted all over her arms. She grabbed my wrist so tight that my fingers became numb.
If Dr. Javier doesn't come, you'll have to be the one to do this for me,
she yelled. I yanked my hands from hers and massaged her arms and taut shoulders to help prepare her body for the birth. Brace yourself, I said. Save your strength for the baby.
Vencida!
She shouted at the ceiling as I dragged her house dress above her head.
I'm going to think of nothing but you, Vencida, until this pain becomes a child.
Let the air enter and leave your mouth freely, I suggested. I remembered my mother saying that it was important that the women breathe normally if they wanted to feel less pain.
I feel a kind of vertigo,
she said, twitching like live flesh on fire. Thrashing on the bed, she gulped desperate mouthfuls of air. Even though her face was swelling, the veins throbbing like a drumbeat along her temples.
I will not have my baby like this,
she said, trying to pin herself to a sunken spot in the middle of the bed.
I will not permit anyone to walk in and see me bare, naked.
Please, Signora, give this all your attention.
At least you'll cover my legs if they come.
She grabbed her belly with both hands to greet another surge of pain. I felt the contents of my stomach rise and settle in the middle of my chest when the baby's head entered her canal. Still, I felt some relief, even though I know she did not. I told myself, now I can see a child will truly come of this agony. This is not entirely impossible. In spite of my hopefulness, the baby stopped coming forward and lay at the near end of her birth canal, as though it had suddenly changed its mind and decided not to leave. Numbed by the pain, the Signora did not move either. Signora, it is time, I said.
Time for what?
She asked, her small rounded teeth hammering her lower lip. It's time to push out your child. I see the head. The hair is dark and soft, in ringlets like yours. She pushed with all her might, like an ant trying to move a tree. The head slipped down, feeling my open hand. Signora, this child will be yours, I said to soothe her. You will be its mother for the rest of your days. It will be yours like watercress belongs to water, and river lilies belong to the river.
Like I belonged to my mother,
she chimed in, catching her breath. Now you will know for yourself why they say children are the prize of life.
Be quick, she commanded. I want to see it. I want to hold it. I want to know if it is a girl or a boy.
Her forehead creased with anticipation. She tightened every muscle and propelled the child's shoulders forward. The infant's body fell into my arms, covering my house apron with blood. You have a son. I proudly raised the child from between her legs and held him up so she could see. The umbilical cord stretched from inside her. As I cradled the boy child against my chest, I wiped him clean with an embroidered towel that I'd cut and stitched myself soon after I learned of the conception. I rapped twice on his bottom, but he did not cry. It was Signor Valencia who cried instead.
I always thought it would be a girl, she said. Every Sunday when I came out of Mass, all the little boys would crowd around my belly as though they were in love with her.
Like Signora Valencia, her son was coconut cream-colored, his cheeks and forehead the blush pink of water lilies.
Is he handsome? Or all his fingers and toes there? She asked. I don't think I heard him cry.
I thought I would leave it to you to strike him again. I felt a sense of great accomplishment as I tore a white ribbon from one of the cradle pillows, wrapped it around the umbilical cord, then used one of the Signora's husband's shaving blades to sever the boy from his mother. Signora Valencia was opening her arms to take him when a yell came. Not from him, but from her. A pained squawk from the back of her throat.
It starts again,
she screamed. What do you feel, Signora?
The birth pains again.
It is your baby's old nest forcing its way out, I said, remembering one of my mother's favorite expressions. The baby's old nest took its time coming out. It was like another child altogether. You have to push once more to be certain it all leaves you. She pushed even harder than before. Another head of curly black hair slid down between her legs, swimming out with the afterbirth. I hurried to put her son down in the cradle and went back to fetch the other child. I was feeling more experienced now. Reaching in the same way, I pulled out the head. The tiny shoulders emerged easily, then the scraggly legs. The firstborn wailed as I drew another infant from between Signora Valencia's thighs. A little girl gasped for breath, a thin brown veil, like layers of spiderwebs covering her face. The umbilical cord had curled itself in a bloody wreath around her neck, encircling every inch between her chin and shoulders. Signora Valencia tore the cowl from her daughter's face with her fingers. I used the blade to snip the umbilical cord from around her neck, and soon the little girl cried, falling into a chorus with her brother.
It's a curse, isn't it?
The Signora said, taking her daughter into her arms. "Hey, Carl, end the umbilical cord too?" She gently blew her breath over her daughter's closed eyes, encouraging the child to open them. I took the little boy out of the cradle now and brought him over to the bed to be near his mother and sister. The two babies stopped crying when we rubbed the soles of their feet together. Señora Valencia used the clean end of a bedsheet to wipe the blood off her daughter's skin. The girl appeared much smaller than her twin, less than half his already small size. Even in her mother's arms, she lay on her side with her tiny legs pulled up to her belly. Her skin was a deep bronze between the colors of nutshells and black salsify. Señora Valencia motioned for me to move even closer with her son.
"They differ in appearance."
She wanted another opinion. "Your son favors cherimoya milk color," I said.
"And my daughter favors you,"
she said.
"My daughter is a chameleon. She's taken your color from the mere sight of your face."
Her fingers still trembling, she made the sign of the Holy Cross from her forehead down to the sweaty cave between her swollen breasts. It was an especially hot morning. The air was heavy with the scent of lemongrass and flame trees losing their morning dew to the sun, and with the smell of all the blood the Señora had lost to her children. I refastened the closed patio doors, completely shutting out the outside air.
"Will you light a candle to La Virgencita Amabel? I promised her I would do this after I gave birth."
I lit a white candle and set it on the layette chest beside the cradle that had been the Señora's own as a child.
"Do you think the children will love me?"
she asked. "Don't you already love them?"
"I feel as if they've always been here."
"Do you know what you will name them?"
"I think I'll name my daughter Rosalinda Teresa to honor my mother. I'll leave it to my husband to name our son. Amabel, I'm so happy today. You and me, look at what we have done."
"It was you, Señora. You did this."
"How does my daughter look? How do you find my dusky rose? Does she please you? Do they please you? She's so small. Take her, please, and let me hold my son now."
We exchanged children. For a moment, Rosalinda seemed to be floating between our hands, in danger of falling. I looked into her tiny face, still streaked with her mother's blood, and I cradled her more tightly in my arms.
"Amabel, do you think my daughter will always be the color she is now?"
Señora Valencia asked.
"My poor love, what if she's mistaken for one of your people?"
3. In the awakened dark, Sebastian says, "If we are not touching, then we must be talking. We must talk to remind each other that we are not yet in the slumbering dark, which is an endless death like a darkened cave. I tell him that I would rather he touch me, stroke me in all the same places, in all the same ways. He is too tired, he says, so we must talk." Silence to him is like sleep, a close second to death. He asks about my family, what my parents were like when they were alive. "What was it you admired most about your mother?" At times, I like it when he is just a deep echo, one utterance after another, feeling every crevice of the room, a voice that sounds like it's never been an infant's whimper, a boy's whisper, a young man's mumble. A voice that speaks as if every word it has ever uttered has always been and will always be for me. "Tell me what you liked most about your mother," he asks again, when I spend too much time admiring the voice and not answering. "I liked her tranquility," I say. "She was a woman who did everything slowly, in her own time, as my father liked to say. She was a woman of few words. When she did speak, her words were direct and precise. The baby's old nest took its time coming out. It was like another child altogether. She was a stern-faced woman with a half-gourd for a forehead, that is to say, her forehead was big, high, and wide, like mine, a sign of a good mind, some say. She didn't show a lot of affection to me. I think she believed this was not a good way to raise a girl who might not have affection the rest of her life. She also didn't smile often. You don't smile often. She was a thin woman like me. I think I look like her, but I do smile more. Are you smiling now? I can hear him smiling in the dark. The smile blends into his voice, slightly halting his speech now and then. His fingers slice the air towards me. Before his hands land on either side of my waist, I'm already squealing and cackling like a sick hen, already feeling as if I'm being tickled. Tell me something more of your mother, he says, once the tickling and more squealing have stopped. Tell me what her name was. Her name was Irel Pradel, I say, and after she died, when I dreamt of her, she was always smiling, except, of course, when she and my papa were drowning. 4. Dr. Javier dashed straight to Senora Valencia's bed as soon as he arrived. When he walked into the room, she quickly announced,
Amabel and I have done it, Javier. We have given birth to the children twins.
Dr. Javier was a remarkably tall man who seemed to be looking down at everyone around him. His squinting eyes appeared dangerous and fierce as he examined the children, clipping their umbilical cords closer to their bellies.
How long was it, your labor?
He asked Senora Valencia.
It began last night, she answered.
Why didn't you send for me then?
Remember the way we'd counted? I thought it could not be time yet.
We misjudged things, perhaps.
The children and me, we are lucky Amabel knew how to birth babies, she said. I could never have done it by myself.
We are all grateful to Amabel.
Dr. Javier smiled at me as he brushed aside his wiry auburn hair, which extended in a widow's peak to the middle of his forehead. A small wooden carving of cane leaves was pinned to the collar of his embroidered shirt. It was a charm, like the amulets the cane cutters in Alegria wore around their necks to protect them from evil spells.
Amabel, boil some water, please, the doctor said. The little ones will need a wash.
The house stood at the top of a hill with a view of the azure-green mountains in the back and a wide road in front. I went out the back door, where the pantry opened onto the grounds. Rushing to my room, I took off my apron and blouse and piled them both in a corner near the latrines. Far down the hill, I could see the housemaid, Juana, returning from the stream with a bucket full of clothes on her head. Juana and her man Luis had worked for Papi even before Senora Valencia was born. Juana stopped at their house, whose peaked roof lay half buried in the grassy hill. I put the pot of water to boil on a bed of charcoal in my own outdoor cooking shed, and waited for Juana to come up. From the yard, I also saw the tightly closed shutters of Senora Valencia's room. They were painted indigo blue, like most of the main house, except for the wraparound veranda, which was the crimson red of Alegria's flame trees at high bloom. Juana did not climb up, so I returned to Senora Valencia's room with two enameled basins full of warm water, carrying one on the crown of my head and the other one in my hands. Senora Valencia was fully covered from chin to toe, the sheets mounded in a pile in the corner.
Papi had removed the mattresses from her bed, replacing them with the clean ones from her mother's old bed in the sewing room. Dr. Javier helped me put the containers down on the layette chest. He poured some medicine in the water with which to bathe the children. Señora Valencia handed him her son.
Amabel, do you remember precisely what time the children were born?
Papi asked. He had a notebook on his lap in which to inscribe the details for the birth certificates.
It was still morning.
Señora Valencia looked up at an old clock set in a mahogany case that Papi had been sent from Spain by his father some 20 years before. I looked over Papi's shoulder as he wrote ceremoniously in his best script the time and place of the births, noting that it was on the 13th of August, the year 1937, the 93rd year of independence. In the 7th year of the era of Generalissimo Rafael Leonida Trujillo Molina, Supreme Commander-in-Chief, President of the Republic.
And how long apart were the children born, Amabel? Asked Papi. Do you remember?
The second one was a surprise. I don't know, I said.
Not more than a quarter of an hour later, offered Señora Valencia.
When it was her turn to be bathed, Dr. Javier took Rosalinda and dipped her in the water. She remained still as the water met her skin.
She has a little charcoal behind the ears, that one,
Dr. Javier boldly told Señora Valencia as he lifted her daughter from the water.
It must be from her father's family,
Papi interjected, his fingertips caressing the skin of his sun-scorched white face.
My daughter was born in the capital of this country. Her mother was of pure Spanish blood. She can trace her family to the conquistadores, the line of El Almirante, Cristobal Colón. And I myself was born near a seaport in Valencia, Spain.
We swaddled the babies in the white bands that I had hemmed during Señora Valencia's pregnancy, when she thought she would only have a girl. She took her daughter in her arms, while Papi stared down at his grandson, rocking him back and forth across his chest.
You make a very impolite assertion,
Papi scolded Dr. Javier in a low voice when he thought his daughter wasn't listening.
We don't want to hear anything more of the kind. Amabel, could I trouble you for un cafecito?
Dr. Javier thought it best to escape from Papi's presence.
Give him anything he wants,
Papi said without looking up from his grandson's face. Dr. Javier followed me to the pantry. As he passed through the doorway, a suspended bundle of dried parsley leaves brushed his scalp, leaving behind a few tiny stems in his hair. I reached up to flick them away but stopped myself in time.
It would be too forward of me to touch him. He might misunderstand.
Working for others, you must always be on your guard. Dr. Javier always addressed me kindly, but I could not presume that he would enjoy the feel of my hand wandering through his hair.
Amabel, were you a midwife all this time and you never told us?
He asked. I don't think myself a midwife, doctor. Some of the coffee spilled as I poured it into a red orchid-patterned cup, set it on its saucer on a silver tray in front of him.
How do you know how to birth those children?
My mother and father were herb healers in Haiti. When it was called for, they birthed a child, I said, wanting to be modest on behalf of my parents, who had always been modest themselves.
Valencia tells me the little girl had a struggle, he said.
She had a caul over her face, and the umbilical cord was badly placed, yes.
Badly placed around her neck? It's as if the other one tried to strangle her.
If you will permit me, doctor, I would rather not condemn these little children by speaking such things.
Many of us start out as twins in the belly and do away with the other, he persisted. When I was a medical student,
One time we found the two small legs of a baby separately lodged in the back of a grown male cadaver. No other manner to explain this, save that these legs had been lodged in the man since before he was born. I thought perhaps he told me this to unnerve me. Many people who considered themselves clever found pleasure in frightening the household workers with marvelous tales of the outside world, a world they supposed we would never see for ourselves. On the other hand, he continued, sometimes you have two children born at the same time. One is stillborn, but the other one alive and healthy because the dead one gave the other a life transfusion in the womb and, in essence, sacrificed itself. I am thankful ours both survived, I said. Aside from medicine, my passions are language and lineage, he said. That little Rosalinda teaches me something when I look at her. Was he showing off more of his knowledge for my sake? Now that our old friend, the Senora's husband, is an officer, I never know what to call him, he said. His rank changes so often. If I remember, he was last a colonel. I have not seen him for some time. He returns from the barracks often enough, I said, trying to make my way out of the conversation. When he's at home, you're always elsewhere. You should ask Senora Valencia your questions, Doctor. I'm weary of military men, he said, not discouraged by my lack of interest. They don't often like me. Those men of the Guardia, even those like Pico, who are old acquaintances. But let us put this thought aside for a moment. Amabel, what I wish to tell you is this. I'm quite anxious about the little girl. Isn't she healthy? I asked. If Valencia feeds her well, she could become robust in a few weeks. But she is so small. Can you make certain that she nurses her often? Please tell Juana too. She may also be looking after the children. And the boy? He looks healthy. It's little Rosalinda who makes me anxious. He turned his empty cup upside down on the saucer, a signal that he didn't want any more coffee. Let me also say this to you, Amabel. You should leave here and become a midwife in Haiti. I felt my eyebrows shoot up, my mouth forming a grimace that might be interpreted as a smile. I am not a midwife, I said, and I haven't been across the border since I was a child of 8 years. You can be trained, he said. Valencia once told me that you can read and write. People like you are needed at the small clinic I sometimes visit across the river. We have only 2 Haitian doctors for a large area. I cannot go there all the time, and I know of only 1 or 2 midwives in that region of the border. You are greatly needed. You're kind to think so highly of me, Doctor. Would you like to go? There is much to consider. Consider all of it, then, he said as he left me. I was still feeling pleased by the doctor's proposal when Juana walked into the pantry with the house linen folded in the basket. I received some coffee from my sisters today, Juana said. Juana's 2 younger sisters, Ana and Maria, were both nuns living in a convent orphanage in a mountain village close to the border. Juana pulled a ripe yellow mango out of her pocket and handed it to me. I know you would have picked that one if you passed it on the tree, she said. I immediately sank my teeth into the mango, letting the thick, heavy juices fill my mouth. How is the senora? She asked. Didn't you hear the screams? What screams? The senora in labor. Baby? Babies. She dropped the linen basket on the floor, then bent down and picked up all the scattered sheets. Juana was a heavy woman whose every movement was exaggerated by the expanse of her flesh. Her pale hands were large, but fragile-looking, as though they would explode if you stuck a needle in them.
How many babies?
She asked, her head bobbing with excitement.
How many could it be? She's not a hen.
Two?
One boy and one girl. Twin babies in this house?
She said, crossing herself.
This is for certain the doing of Santa's Felicitas and Perpetua. Where's the Senora now?
In her room with Dr. Javier.
Oh, it was Santa Monica's doing, bringing Dr. Javier on time.
He came too late, I said, neglecting the modesty I had been taught in childhood by my parents. I birthed the babies myself. It happened so quickly. You would call it a miracle.
Miracles always happen in my absence, she said. I have to tell Luis.
She rushed out of the pantry, then came running back in.
First, I must see the señora and the babies for myself.
I put my mango down. We walked to Señora Valencia's room. Juana burst into tears as soon as she saw the children. Rosalinda in her mother's arms, and a little boy undergoing another close examination by Dr. Javier. Señora Valencia held Rosalinda out towards Juana.
Take her, she said. Wouldn't you like to hold my daughter, Juana? I'm afraid I will cry, Juana sobbed. You're already crying, Señora Valencia observed.
Peeking at the little boy, Juana approached the bed.
I've named my daughter Rosalinda Teresa, Señora Valencia said. For your mommy,
Juana sobbed louder now.
Oh, had your mother lived to see this day, she would have been so joyful.
Then why are you crying? Señora Valencia said.
It's a happy day. Your mother would have been crying too, more tears of joy than tears of sadness.
I will go to the barracks to fetch Pico,
Papi said. I want to come back before dark.
Don't go alone, Don Ignacio.
Juana stepped in front of him, with Rosalinda resting in her arms.
No need to worry. I'll go with God, Papi said, a trace of impatience in his voice.
Yes, please, go with God, but also take Luis with you,
Juana urged.
He's in the banana grove, cutting a few bananas for me. I don't know how he missed hearing all of this.
We'll try to return tonight,
Papi said, kissing his daughter's hand.
Señora, you rest, Juana said. Amabel and me, we'll look after everything.
Don't spoil her too much,
Dr. Javier cautioned.
Valencia, don't let the kindness of these good women spoil you.
Pobrecita, this is her time of risk, said Juana. She must spend the necessary number of days lying in, resting, both for herself and for the children.
5. Sebastian, who is from the north of Haiti like I am, though we did not know each other when we lived there, feels haunted by the crooning of pigeons. Their cry, he says, sounds like it's not meant for the others to hear, but like each howling pigeon is trying to bury its head deep inside itself. He imagines that the way pigeons moan is the same way ghosts cry when they are too lonely or too sad, when they have been dead so long that they have forgotten how to speak their own names. Sebastian's father was killed in the great hurricane that struck the whole island, both Haiti and Dominican Republic, in 1930. He lost his father and almost everything else. This is why he left Haiti. This is why I have him. A sweep of winds that destroyed so many houses and killed so many people brought him to me. Sebastian's mother is still alive in Haiti. Sometimes, when we are almost asleep together, Sebastian will hear a pigeon. The pigeon he hears, and I don't always hear them, tend to go on moaning night after night, with their mysterious calls and their mysterious language. The pigeons always make him draw in his breath, suck his teeth and say, "Ay, pobrecita mamá muere." My poor mother. 6. Dr. Javier went off to see a young man who was bedridden with chills and a fever. He promised to return to visit the children once more before nightfall. Juana was in the pantry preparing chicken soup for the señora, a soup made from the meat of an old hen, and a stew for the rest of the household. The children were sleeping in their cradle as Señora Valencia lay in her bed, everything but her face covered by several blankets. I walked over to look at the babies. Dwarfed by her brother, Rosa Linda lay completely still. I reached in and picked her up. Señora Valencia turned over on her side and saw me holding her daughter. "Amabel, put her face on your breast," she said. Rosa Linda remained asleep while I unbuttoned my blouse and placed her tiny cheek between my breasts and collarbone. I could instantly feel the air streaming in and out of her nose, her breathing falling into step with the beating of my heart. "Isn't it miraculous?" Señora Valencia's eyes traveled back between her daughter and her son, as though there was nothing else in the world she could see. "Javier says that they can't see anything except the light and the dark for the first days. I don't believe him." Señora Valencia motioned for me to come sit on the bed next to her. I put Rosa Linda back in her cradle and walked towards her mother. "Amabel, I must confess something," she said. "When I had you light the candle to La Virgencita after the children were born, it was really for my mother. I promised her I'd light her a candle after I gave birth. Last night, when my first pains began, I felt like my mother was with me. I'd been having more than my usual number of dreams since I became with child, but last night did not feel like a dream. My mother sat here next to me, in this bed. She put her arms around me and touched my stomach. This is why I did not scream until the last moment. I never felt alone." She turned to look at the white candle on the layette chest, the wick half buried in a mass of melted paraffin, the flame long since extinguished by all the movements in the room. "I wish you had known, Mommy, Amabel," she said. "I wish I had known her as well, Signora. But her mother had died even before my parents had drowned, leaving us both to parent all our childhood dreams out of ourselves." Juana walked in with a tray of steaming soup and a sweet tea brew and placed them on the bed in front of Signora Valencia. "Eat well, Signora," she said. "Remember, the children feed from you." Tears began to stream down Juana's face again. She turned to me and said, "See that the señora eats." And then she ran out of the room. Juana was at Mommy's side both times Mommy was pregnant, Señora Valencia explained. I placed an embroidered shawl around the señora's neck and handed her a spoon. After the señora had eaten a few spoonfuls, Rosa Linda began to whimper. I picked her up and brought her to her mother. "My tiny little one, she must grow strong. Or how will she defend herself when her brother wants to tussle?" Señora Valencia said as she took her from my hands. "I can't wait for Pico to see the children. I hope he and Papi will return tonight." "I know the señora will want to come," I said. "My Pico is so full of ambition. He told me that he's dreamed since he was a boy of advancing in the army, and one day of becoming president of this country."
"And you the wife of the president, señora?"
"I wouldn't like it," she said.
wrinkling her nose, as though smelling something sour. When Pico procures everything he wants, he might not want me anymore. As a boy, he was so poor. Now he can't accept that he has a bit of comfort, and he doesn't have to fight to make the sun rise every morning.
The senor's work is important. I told her what I knew she also believed.
I wish I could see him more, she said. I miss the dark taste of cigars in his mouth.
Señora Valencia raised the little girl up to her shoulder, as if she has already been doing it all her life.
I've thought of everything I want to tell the children, she said. Things they might need to know, and other things as well, where I may have to hold my tongue.
You know what best to do, Señora.
What you did for me today, Amabel, Mummy should have been here to do, except she was like me and would have been screaming in agony too.
She threw her head back and laughed at the pain linking her with her mother. Amabel, after my mommy died, Juana told me that in our faith, if there is a choice between a baby and a mother during a birth, you must choose the baby.
I am glad we never had to choose, Señora.
If you'd had to make this choice, I'd want you to look after my children. See what we've brought forth together, my Spanish prince and my Indian princess.
Wouldn't you like to be a princess? Señora Valencia murmured into her daughter's face.
She will steal many hearts, my Rosalinda. Look at that profile. The profile of Ana Caona, a true Indian queen.
Juana and I will sleep in the house with you tonight, I offered to the señora.
Juana will only drown us in more of her tears, she chuckled.
I will ask her to call on the patron saint of tears to stop hers.
I think it is best if she sleeps in her own house and you in your room.
One of us must stay with you, even if Señor Pico returns.
I left the señora to the care of one of her husband's girl cousins, who had come from the village with more old hen soup, eggs, nutmeg, money, and dog's teeth for the baby's protection, and went down to the pantry to find Juana. Juana was sitting at the table, stirring a wooden spoon around the plate of stew in front of her. Her eyes were red from all the crying she had done. She got up and ladled out a bowl of stew from the pot for me. I think a tear or two might have fallen in the stew while you were cooking, I said as I sat at the table next to her. I didn't realize how hungry I was until I saw the chunks of cabbage, yucca, and manioc floating in my bowl.
There are no tears in your bowl, Juana said. I was careful. Nothing but what is meant to be there ever enters my stew.
I was not serious, I said, patting the cushion of flesh on her back.
Don't tease me. What if the señora heard you?
Why are you crying so, Juana? I don't believe they're all for joy, your tears.
It's a grand day in this house, she said, a day that comes to remind me how quickly time passes by. A woman like me grows old while more and more children arrive in this world.
Are you jealous, Juana? Do you want your own babies?
Jealous? Santa Ana, the holy mother who gives life, what if she heard you?
She rapped her knuckles on the four corners of the table, as though to test the strength of the wood, and then picked up a rag and wiped the already clean table legs.
If she has ears, then Santa Ana, she's already heard everything I said.
The sin's on your head, then, she said. But you're not a believer.
How do you know I'm not a believer?
Do you believe in anything?
Juana rubbed her closed hands together, as though washing in the stream. After years of working as a housemaid, it was hard for her to remain still.
I remember when Señora Valencia's mother became pregnant with her, she said. One day, She had no menstrual rags for me to wash. I said to her, Signora Rosalinda, could you be with child? She said to me, Juana, I dare not even dream it. I said, why? She said, it would be too miraculous. She was with child indeed, and during the first and second months, her body became so uneasy. She grew larger and larger until she was too wide for most passageways in this house. If anyone looked like they were going to have twin babies, it was Señora Rosalinda.
Juana stood up and poured another bowl of stew for herself. She'd had an enormous appetite over these past few months and had grown even broader, especially around her face.
Now Señora Valencia has children of her own.
She pondered the event out loud.
Look how quick the time has passed.
It's not the time itself, but what it does to us.
You're far from old, I said. She was at least 50, twice my and Señora Valencia's age, but her body looked hardy and capable, like it could still bear many children. You don't know how long I prayed for a child myself, she said. I have no child, but even I know you must do more than pray. Sinner, she laughed, and playfully slapped the back of my hand. So you've wanted babies? I asked. Babies always lead us to talk of more babies. Don't you want to have your own? I shook my head no. Perhaps because my parents both had died young, I never imagined myself getting older than I was, much less living long enough to bear my own children. Before Sebastian, all my dreams had been of the past, of the old country, of places and people I might never see again. I was close to becoming a mother once, Juana said. My stomach grew for 3 months and 9 days. Then all at once, it was gone. Adios, bebe. This child was never born. It never had a sex, never had a name. My Luis, he loves children. If they could grow out of the ground, he would have grown one for me long ago. At this moment in life, a woman asks herself, what good is all this flesh? Why did I have this body?
Juana and her sisters had been raised in a convent school where their mother was the cook. She was going to be a nun like her two sisters until she met Luis. She and Luis left together and settled in the valley. Juana thought she couldn't have children because she had abandoned her calling. Even her lost pregnancy must have seemed like a deserved punishment from a god she had defied.
Look at me, she said, rotating her arms as though she were ironing. I have no need to cry for myself. I must cry for Doña Rosalinda, who died in the attempt to bring a second child into the family. And I must cry for Señora Valencia, who's without her mother on this day.
7. One night, in the awakened dark, when he is missing his father, Sebastian asks, what was it that you admired most about your father? I pretend that I cannot remember, but he insists,
please tell me, Amabel. I wish to know this.
My father's name was Anton Desir.
I say because I know he will ask it again.
I always heard people call him Fue Anton, Brother Anton, like they called my mother Man Irel, Mother Irel. My mother was older than him, I believe, and some say she looked it.
Tell me what you liked most about him, your father.
Sebastian's voice is more hesitant than usual. It's as though he really does not want to know, like he would rather I say I never had a father, but he knows I had one, whom I lost like he lost his.
My father was joyful, contrary to my mother's quietly unhappy ways, I admit. He used to pick me up and try to throw me up in the air, even when I became too heavy to be carried. Even when everything he did ceased to seem like a miracle to me. He liked to make like he was going to eat my food if he finished his plate before I finished mine. He spent a lot of time doing the birthing and healing work. He was always looking for some new way to heal others, searching for cures for illnesses that he had not yet even encountered. Aside from the birthing and healing work he and my mother did together, he spent a lot of time outside the house trying to help other people plow their fields and dig waterways to their land. I was always very jealous of the time he spent on other people's land. I can tell he is ready. He wants me to ask about his dead father. I can tell by the endless pause after I'm done speaking, the way he opens his mouth now and again, and then only sighs as if to ask himself where he could possibly make himself begin. How did the hurricane find your father? I end up saying. It is not the gentlest or most deft way to ask, but I believe it will help him speak. He opens his mouth a few more times and moans. If you let yourself, he says finally, you can see it before your eyes. A boy carrying his dead father from the road, wobbling, swaying, stumbling under the weight. The boy with the wind in his ears and pieces of the tin roofs that opened the father's throat, blowing around him. The boy trying not to drop the father, not crying or screaming like you'd think, but praying that more of the father's blood will stay in the father's throat and not go into the muddy flood, going no one knows where. If you let yourself, you can see it before your eyes. 8. Señor Pico Duarte bore the name of one of the fathers of Dominican independence, a name that he had shared with the tallest mountain on the island until recently, when it was rechristened Pico Trujillo after the Generalissimo. Yet, at 36 years of age, Señor Pico Duarte was still shorter than the average man, even in his military boots, which seemed to add height to the other officers. With his honey-almond skin and charcoal eyes, he was the one that baby Rosalinda resembled most. The floor thundered under his boots as he ran from Poppy's automobile into the house to find his wife and newborn children, looking for hints of their presence in the parlor and all the different rooms in the house. Juana and I both followed him blindly, instinctively, to his wife's room, thinking perhaps he might need something we could bring for him, or his wife, or their new children. Working for others, you learn to be present and invisible at the same time, nearby when they needed you, far off when they didn't, but still close enough in case they changed their minds. Juana was more herself now. She watched with a reserved smile as Señor Pico rushed to the bed where his wife lay and kissed her hair and forehead.
Pico, let me see your face, she said, her fingers pulling at his bristly tar-black hair.
Go look at the children, Poppy urged him with a hearty laugh.
As he stood over his children's cradle, Señor Pico's body shook as though he wanted to scream. He held his fist to his mouth to contain his joy. His eyes lingered on his son, his heir. Raising the sheet covering the child's body, he peeked beneath his diaper to check the boy's testicles.
I will name him Rafael for the Generalissimo, he said, as Juana re-swaddled the children even more securely than before.
The Señora agreed to this name with a coy nod. And so the boy became Rafael like the Generalissimo, the president of the